Hi everybody, welcome back to No Killing Goblins. Today's episode, we have another guest. We have Gunman, the wonderful radio-voiced, godlike Gunman, with us today to discuss chapters 2.31 and 2.32. Is that... Did I remember? I forgot which ones we're doing, actually.
You got it correct, Oshi, and it is glad to be back here.
Actually, no, I didn't get it correct, because it's 2.32... And 2.33. God damn it, I'm stupid.
It's the thought that counts.
So how you doing, Gunman? How you been?
It's been a long time. I am doing quite all right. Everything's been going well as of late. How about yourself?
I'm hot and sweaty, and I do not like the summer when it starts off.
Well, I'd recommend turning on the fan if that helps.
It does not.
Well, then you need a better fan.
Yeah, it's not about the fan. It's, remember, fans move air. If the air is full of humidity and heat, it's still going to feel like a blast of hot air in the face. So, yeah.
Wow. And yet when you're driving down the interstate at 60 miles an hour on a hot summer day, it still feels pretty cool.
When you're driving down the interstate, it's usually in a large open space and the wind is blowing, so, you know, it's not just you. Maybe more coolness there, isn't there?
Maybe the solution is that you just need an industrial fan.
Oh, that's not a bad idea. Maybe I could shove one into a corner of the room.
There we go.
Yeah, that's the way to do it. All right, let's not speak of the fans. Let's speak of the fans. What the hell's been going on lately that we can talk about?
That's a nice Dean Kamen right there.
What's a Dean Kamen?
He was the inventor of the Segway.
Oh, it's a Segway. Oh, I get you. The car?
No, anywho, not the car.
You can tell I'm very, very manly, because I don't even know what the fuck a Segway... I know what it is, that it is a vehicle, but I can't tell you what it looks like.
It was those weird motorized scooters that you stand on.
Is that what a Segway is?
Yes.
I thought those were... I just think of them as scooters. Is it... You know they have those in New York, like they, or at least in my neighborhood, because we're super gentrified now and all the white people moved in, and they now have bike lanes. So every time I went to do the laundry today, and the entire time I was, like, dragging all of my shit between the laundromat and my house, all I could see was all of these tattooed hipster dudes running, like, riding along the side of the road, along the bike paths, in scooters.
I understand and how you feel. I dislike hipsters as well.
I don't know. It's just, life has changed greatly. I feel very old. And I'm shorter than everybody, so it's unfair. Have you read anything good lately?
I actually just finished reading a Warhammer 40,000 book called The Twice Dead King Ruin, which, I gotta say, I did not expect so much characterization to come out of a Necron book, but, well, there you go. I currently have the second one, second-hand copy of the sequel to it coming from I ordered it off of Amazon, and it should be here sometime within the week.
I made a book list yesterday, so we've had a guest on a few times recently who writes the summaries. I think you know of him, Muffins.
I do not know anyone from the Reddit. I only know people from the Discord.
Okay, so he writes these recaps, and he's been real fun. He's Scottish. Anyway, I was talking to him, and he saw telling me about anime, and I went ahead...
I'm sorry for you.
What's wrong with anime? What's wrong with Spy X Family? Come on.
Oh, I like it. That doesn't change the fact I dislike anime.
Jesus Christ. Okay.
There's no one who hates weebs more than other weebs.
Well, that's true.
I'm not a weeb, but I still hate them.
I agree with that. That's a good assessment. Self-hatred is the building block of all weebs. What was I going to say? Right, so I was talking to him about anime and stuff, and I started making a book list for June, because I don't know if you know this, but a lot of times what happens is traditional publishing companies release books in batches, and it's usually scheduled around, like, the big days, like the holidays will have a huge number of releases because everybody buys books for the holidays, and then they'll have like the spring releases and the summer releases. So a lot of the summer books are coming out, and I made a nice little book list. And apparently I've been called out as being, like, highfalutin, because I go to Tor.com and I look through this thing called Fantasy Affliction, which is a listing of all the books that are supposed to come out. There used to be a much more, like, fan-driven one, like a blog post system that existed way back in the day, but they closed that, like, 2016 or something, because all the blogs for reading died. Rest in peace.
Rest in peace.
I mean, where do you go to find out about books?
Well, it depends what the source is. In the case of anything that's Warhammer related, I would go to my local Games Workshop and then see if there's any good novels. In the case of anything else, well, usually I don't read... I usually don't read books. Hard, like, physical books. But occasionally I'll come across something either through... learning it through, like, a YouTube video or a friend recommendation or any number of other things. Currently sitting on my desk is actually a book called Atomic Habits, An Easy and Proven Way to Build Good Habits and Break Bad Ones. And, well, as much as I like to say I have my life in order, there's some things I wish I could polish up on, so I plan on taking a crack at it sometime soon.
Well, that's not a bad thing. A lot of people enjoy the kind of self-improvement topic. There's this YouTube channel with a couple of 20-year-olds. I can't believe I can say that unironically now. A couple of 20-year-olds who are very scientific, and they talked a lot about... I forget what the name of the goddamn channel is at this point. But they talked a lot about self-improvement and how you can better yourself and how... And it was a weird thing because it reminded me of this conversation I had, or maybe I listened to it. And it was all about how in your early to mid-20s, you're always... obsessed. If you're trying to improve yourself, you're always obsessed with, like, efficiency and trying to get yourself to a point where you are doing the most with every little thing. And I remember the conversation being about, like, blenders, and the person had, like, a full-on, like, tiered Excel list where they researched, like, 30 different blenders before they bought the perfect one for themselves.
Okay, that's just weird.
I don't know if that's weird. I think...
That is absolutely weird. I do not know anyone in my own age group that does that. That just seems hyper-obsessive, to put it mildly.
Okay, that's the extreme. But even so, you do take tough time to, like, look through things and find the good stuff. You know, you're trying to find the deal and things.
Meanwhile, I'm not usually. I tend to find something that's terrible, and then I work my way up until I find good quality. Hence why I ended up seeing enough terrible isekai before I stumbled upon The Wandering Inn, then I learned what quality was, and I've been jaded ever since.
I mean...
As far as self-help goes, I absolutely hate the term self-help books, because if you need self-help from anywhere other than yourself, then that's not self-help, that's just help.
It's just help. I don't know why they call it self-help. Also, a lot of the books aren't really that amazing. All they're trying to do is get across to you an idea that you figure out 20 years later when you're in your 30s and 40s, is that you can make mistakes and you can learn from them and you can pick yourself back up and grow. It took me 15 years to learn that, and a self-help book would not have changed my mind or helped me figure it out.
That's a good point. Speaking of making mistakes and improving, we are now 9 minutes into this podcast about The Wandering Inn, and we haven't talked about The Wandering Inn. So, let's talk about it.
No, I'm not done talking yet. I'm tired of talking about The Wandering Inn. All my life is... No, listen, I give 15 minutes. Cut this part out, guys. I give 15 minutes of conversation before we start on it.
We're keeping this in.
Why are you doing this to me, Dunman? Because I'm the one who does the transition. I'm the host.
It's because I am an asshole.
Okay, we'll talk about The Wandering Inn, since you don't want to have a conversation with me, because clearly I'm ugly.
Your words, not mine.
Shut up, bastard. All right. So the first chapter we're going to talk about is 2.33. I got it right wrong 3 times now. We're going to start with 2.33, and we're going to talk about 2.34. What is wrong with me? So the first chapter we're going to talk about is 2.33, the 33rd chapter of Volume 2. And it starts off on Kilbekich. The perspective is on Kilbekich, and we have him revealing a certain secret to Olesund through some sneaky moves. And then eventually what happens is that Olesund takes the sneaky thing that Kilbekich gives him, which is a map of Albez, to the newly formed, reformed Horns of Hammerhead in Eren's Inn. And then we find out at the end of the chapter that Ryoka, the horns are headed to Albez, and Ryoka gets found by a butler who invites her to Magnolia's house. I think that's the general gist of what happens in the chapter. So what did you think of the chapter?
It was Eren who got invited by the butler.
Wait, Eren got it? Oh, you're right. It's Eren. It's not Ryoka. My bad. It's because Ryoka was the chapter that I just discussed in another aspect. You're right. It's Eren that gets invited.
Yep. So was your question?
What did you think of the chapter? What were the highlights for you?
This wasn't really much of a chapter that had highlights for me, because this was a setup chapter for future events. But as far as setups go, it definitely grabs attention. The conversation of the secret, as you put it, that Olesund learns, that was a nice little detail. It's good to know that resurrection has consequences to it. And I'm not sure if that kind of stuff is going to come into play later on. Like, if he maybe gets killed off again, I don't know. But it would be interesting to see, because so far it's been established that, oh, he was this amazing legendary warrior, and since then he's fallen from grace quite a fair bit. He's trying to get it back, but he just can't hit that point that he was previously. So I'm curious to know if that's going to come into play any more later on.
What did you think of the horns part?
Of the horns part, it was definitely fun to see the conversation where they were talking about the magic items and the conversation about how they interact with each other, explaining why, you know, you don't just wear 1,000 enchanted items. No, there's actually some sort of like interference that they have with one another. That was a nice detail. That's the kind of stuff you don't really hear about in a lot of fantasy stories. So
Torin is apparently not back yet, or he does return, actually. I'm sorry. He's back. I'm confusing chapters. So Torin's back, and he's terrorizing Leonette, and Syria doesn't approve at all. Although Eren admits to the fact that she's failed in helping or even convincing Leonette to be more of a, or less spoiled. I thought that was fascinating. It's a development that's been going on for a while in the background. And you see someone openly acknowledge the fact that Torin is kind of bullying Leonette. And then you have Eren say that part of the reason that she's okay with this is because she's exhausted and failing at helping her, like, be more of a person and less of a harridan. And that's kind of sad. It's kind of sad. I don't know why I'm mentioning it, but it is sad. But what I did find fascinating was the undercurrents in the first section. On second read, a lot of the little pieces make more sense now. I won't reveal all of them, but there is, like, aspects of Kilbekich's relationship with the Queen, his new position as a Revelinator versus what it is to be a Propagator, and the explicit fact that the Queen and Kilbekich are conspiring to force Kissimver into the situation that he is in. And it's clear that the project that Kissimver is involves him leaving the Hive and interacting with the world. I never really knew what their original plan was. I still don't to this day. Like, I can't, at this point, I still don't really understand from this chapter anything about their plan for him. Like, what do they want from him? What do you think they wanted from him?
If I had to take a guess, it would be that, well,
See,
that's numbers and replacements are the things that the Antinium seem to be very, very good at, whether it's replacing a ton of workers or a ton of soldiers. But people like Kilb, he's just irreplaceable. And when he was out of commission, Kisimver was supposed to be his, you know, like his stand-in, but he did an abysmal job, so now he's going to be, well, going out and seeing the world. So, my guess is that if he's able to go out, see the world, and do more than just the extremely regimented and, like, strict tasks that he's been assigned, such as, like, what the workers or soldiers do, and instead he's able to live life as a person, well, maybe he's actually going to be able to develop and see the potential that he was supposed to have actually be realized.
I guess. And that does make sense. It's just when I think about the framing that Pirate used for this chapter, especially for Kill the Witches' section, he talks about the Antinium as not wasteful. They never waste any resources. It's like a repetitive theme in his mental thought process. Sorry, in the mental voice, excuse me. He talks about that they don't waste things, that they don't waste anyone or anything, and yet they're letting Kisimver leave the Hive. There's also the implication that they have a lot more maps and information because he takes one of the secrets from that special room. So I wonder how much more they know about the stuff in the region, because it made me think about something. So the Antinium are big on digging underground, and technically during the Antinium conflicts, I assume when they got to Israel, they would have dug around a lot of places. Does this chapter kind of implies that when they were digging around a lot of places, they figured out a lot of secrets?
Yeah, I would be willing to bet that they just have an enormous tunnel network that they just have, like, hidden away. Because, like, how many geomancers are there out there? I can only imagine the extent to which people have found the size of the hives and underground tunnels that have been constructed.
Right? There has to be so much behind that. But I thought that was cool. And then we have the horn section. For me, what was big was the dynamics of the horns are being settled. This is like post their fight with the goblins. The first like foray as a group to successfully complete a mission. They're talking about the loot, just like you said, about the magic stuff. But you also see a little bit of the interactivity between like Syria and Pisces. Syria's ability like tell them to shut the fuck up. And the way Kisimver is like deferring to the others, and Yivlon seems kind of a little aloof in this chapter. Was that just me?
She does seem a little aloof, I will say, yeah. Maybe it's because she's now in a position of being a teammate rather than a team leader. With the pressure being taken off of her, she's no longer having to worry about it.
I do wonder if part of it is also an aspect of PTSD and nervousness because she's trying not to let anybody down. I don't know.
Ironically, Kisimver actually seems to be the smartest of the lot because he's so much a fish out of water that he's making no assumptions about how anything should work. So he just takes the, I am ignorant, I will default to your opinions.
I did think that the whole it's a little cliche, but did you like the scene where they kind of like put in hands and refounded the horns of Hammerhead?
You know, sometimes, I'm not sure if that's like an adventurer tradition or anything, of that's how you reform a group, but sometimes cliches are cliches for a reason. They just work.
I know, and I really felt for them, especially after all they've been through, and the kind of way, like, Kisimver's hesitance at this whole thing, like, am I good enough to be part of you, and then Yivlon, and, like, it's really the start of something. It feels like the start of something. Pirates set up the horns in the early volumes, throughout volume one, as this really strong, capable team, and they love, sort of loving in their own way, and then violently killed them all and left the survivors to fend for themselves. And you see that sort of thematic connection between strangers who are working together towards a common goal come back together in this, and I liked it. I really did. It's such a simplistic way to think about it, but it's so... I mean, it works! What can I say?
Honestly, there's no true adventurer that doesn't have, in their own way, a mountain of corpses that they're standing on. Like, even Erin, she's not an adventurer, but just her trying to get all the levels she has up until now, she has had to kill. She has had to be ruthless and violent at times. Like, imagine how many people she's going to end up having to fight either in self-defense or by accident or whatnot, by the time she's gotten to level, say, 50. I dread to imagine what that will be like. And adventurers, in this case, like the newly reformed Horns of Hammerod, they lost so many people just trying to get to this current point. Imagine what they're going to have to go through to get more levels. I'm worried. The story has always been a dark story with bright moments instead of a bright story with dark moments. That's why I've always seen it.
Slice of life war crimes.
Yes, that's slice of life war crimes. That's pretty apt.
It's not the most graceful term, but it works. There is a than a few times.
Grimbright.
Grimbright. I don't know if that. Oh, that's kind of. How are you? How can you be? I guess TWI is the only one who can be Grimbright. But I was gonna mention. So in this chapter, there's also quite a few suggestions that Erin herself becomes an adventurer. And I love how Pirate repeats the theme, and then at the end, she says, maybe I can be an adventurer. And immediately afterwards, Butler appears. Nope, no adventurer. Like, narratively speaking, it's like a big giant sign that says, nope, Erin's not going to be an adventurer. Fuck you.
Yeah, she doesn't... I mean, if she wanted to be an adventurer, she definitely has the will to pull it off. But yeah, that's not her thing. She's way too much of a homebody to, stay out of the inn for too long.
Yeah. And this chapter actually has no goblins in it, and yet it talks a lot about goblins. I mean, Olsen reveals the fact that there's Goblin Lord in the north to everybody, and then there's Rag's tribe that we know is in the south of Israel, or south of Lescor. So there's a lot of goblins all around the Wandering Inn, so you know goblins are going to be coming up too. It's a lot of setup, but it's also a lot of forward movement, it feels like, for the chapter, right?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm looking forward to seeing, how it develops. It's nice to see a chapter that doesn't just set up for what can happen, but actually takes a few steps towards that direction in the same time.
Right. Okay, so do you have any more final thoughts for the chapter?
Not exactly. I think that's just about it.
Okay.
Oh, I did like the fact that Kizumver now doesn't have to worry about food poisoning and can eat bread.
Oh god, yeah. I can't wait till he stuffs himself with bread. Maybe he can eat a cupcake.
Okay. Give him a plate of pasta.
Oh, I guess it's plot.
It's the inn specialty.
I'm not even going to mention the fact that Pirate Abba does not know what cacio e pepe is, or... you know, basic pasta recipes, like all your... Okay, you know what? I'm not going to start... I can't say things in Italian in the first place.
Well, maybe they do, but Erin doesn't.
Anyway. So Pirate's chapter note for this chapter, it was written on... It was published on June 7th, 2017. This is the final bonus chapter I'm writing as thanks for hitting $800 on Patreon. Clap, clap, clap. Pirate hit 800 bucks. That's a nice chunk of change to, pay rent with. If someone doesn't flip over one of the reveals in this chapter, I'm going to be mad. There was a lot of reveals in the chapter, if you think about it. Albez, the goblins, Erin going to Magnolia, the horns being refounded, the fact that Kissenver is, an experiment from the queens, the fact that there was, a cost to the resurrection, and that not everybody can be resurrected, and you have to be kind of individual to have it happen. There was a lot, right?
Absolutely. Some people will just say that a universe, or a fictional story is wide as an ocean, deep as a puddle, but The Wandering Inn, it is wide as an ocean, deep as an ocean. This is the Mariana Trench if it was, the size of the Pacific.
Okay. And a pirate ends the note on, but the drama, question mark? I've got the drama, I think. Let me know what you think. Thanks for reading. Pirate, unless I will agree, that's part of what drew me to pirate, is that they do have a sense for the drama. If they didn't, I wouldn't be as happy. So, if you want to take a few moments and look through the comments, if you find anything that jumps out at you that you want to talk about. If not, I'll just move on.
I say let's move on. Talking about the comments of the chapter that we just read seems a little too meta.
I mean, that's what we've been doing for the last 6 weeks, so...
Well, that's talking about a chapter, not talking about a chapter. It's like why I don't like philosophy too much. Instead of thinking, you're thinking about thinking.
Okay, I just want to read this one comment. So Artorios posts saying on June 8th, 2017, says, first time posting, I'll just leave this. This shit good. G-U-D good. Okay, we'll move on to the next chapter.
Very so, apt.
2.34. So this one, it's another setup chapter, and it starts off with Ryoka and her, you know, tired after running away from the necromancer, and we check in with her. She's gotten past the battle and she's talking to the Fae, and there's like some back and forth, and she eventually hooks up back with the Stone Spheres tribe. And in the meantime, a group of drakes are also following her, led by Zellshiver Trail and with Ilvris in tow. And there's this sense of ominous, like, waiting on this chapter, because all the animals are gone and there's signs that this is all, like, bad stuff is about to happen. And when she gets to the Stone Spears tribe, they give her some food and rest, and Mercia disappears. So, and the Fae repeatedly say that they cannot interfere in mortal affairs. And then she begs the Fae for the help, for their help. And in the process, she makes a deal with the help of the Stone Spheres tribe for Mercia's survival. And in return, they will pay a cost. And the Fae are repeatedly warn Ryoka that they cannot interfere, and that there is a great cost to fate.
In the business, we call this foreshadowing.
Yeah, and because there are rules, and that they have nothing to offer, and there is a lot to unpack here regarding how the Fae interact with the world, and...
This is also the chapter where we get the first bit of deep lore.
Yeah, we'll get into it, but what did you think... If you want to talk about the deep lore, let's talk about the deep lore.
No, we'll get to that. I just wanted to bring it up that it existed.
Okay. So I think this is the first chapter where I think since the party, when the Fae were invited into the Wandering Inn by Erin Solstice to her feast, that the Fae felt like the Fae to me.
Yeah, instead of just some annoying sprites, they actually have that weird ancient mythological wisdom to them.
Right. You feel their age, you feel their presence, and
they're yeah, they're alien.
Yeah. There's a sense that the Fae live in a narrative world where they see things from a very large perspective. Like, imagine you're a single thread, they see the entire tapestry kind of situation. And they clearly have the ability to see where all the pieces will fit together and to influence it. And they're prevented from doing it by, quote-unquote, the rules, so that there is some more than a few implications that the Fae are bound by rules. I mean, it's so clear that the Fae are powerful, but there's also a deep lore drop, as you said, in which the Fae, while interacting with Ryoka, reveal that everyone's a plaything, and that the levels are part of being these quote-unquote playthings. Ryoka admits to them, tells them, or reveals to them that she does not have any levels, and they reluctantly admit that they cannot see if you have levels or not.
Yeah, it was... That was definitely a fascinating reveal, especially the way they put it, of how would we explain it? What good can a slave do with the chains on their neck? But you put it on willingly, didn't you?
Exactly. The line has a lot of implications to it. The idea that there's greater powers in the world is introduced. The idea that, like, it confirms some of Ryoka's suspicions, but at the same time, it's so vague, it's hard to understand what they mean by that implication, because the Fae tend to think in a metaphorical way. So the metaphor might be applicable to that they are quote-unquote slaves and they have chains on their neck and that they willingly put the chains on. But it's all about the meta, it's the way you interpret the metaphor. Because the Fae are all about lying with the truth. Because they never lie. They always tell the truth, but they never quite tell you the exact truth that you think that they are telling you. So from their perspective, she might be a slave. But from another perspective, what if she's not a slave, but she did, like, take on the power of something or make a bargain with something? I don't know. There's a lot. There's so much. My brain kind of exploded the first time I wrote this chapter.
It's definitely funny to see the Fae constantly being... are constantly putting everyone they talk to on the back foot because of just how intelligent, clever, and mischievous they are. Like, not to mention just how powerful they seem to be, but it's really funny how Ryoka, her go-to method with dealing with problems is to try to outsmart them or run away. But in the case of the Fae, she can't do either because the Fae are faster, and when she tries to taunt them into saying, like, oh, unless you don't understand your powers enough to explain how they work in the first place, is that it? And their immediate response is, oh, look, the plaything is trying to be clever. It's like, yeah, you can't outsmart them. In the end of the day, the fairies always win. That's just how it goes. You don't beat the fairies. The best you can do is accept defeat against them and just take the least form of defeat possible.
Right? Just because they see so much more than you. So even when you win, quote-unquote, it's usually the victory is pyrrhic, because whatever you win is nothing compared to how the fairy have maneuvered you into a situation that will, like, you might, like, just with what happened with Erin, she won, quote-unquote, and she got those flowers and the gold, sorry, she got the gold and it was all flowers. Like, she won, she got them to back off and do all those things, but only because the Fae were willing to back off and they wanted a feast. And yeah. She got nothing of real value. She kind of had to... I will say what made Erin's whole thing a little interesting was she did kind of win a little something from the Fae because she got the flowers, right?
And the skill.
And the skill. But the skill was her own, and the flowers were something that the Fae neglected and just figured that she wouldn't be able to do anything with. It was their own mistake. And you begin to realize that even the Fae... like, that little bit kind of made the Fae a little... it's like gods leaving behind ambrosia because they don't really think about the food they eat.
Yeah, it's the equivalent of thinking to yourself, oh yeah, that plate that had some cake on it, I'll just leave it next to my bed and just deal with it in the morning. And then that tiny little crumb of icing that's left out ends up attracting some bugs. It's that teeny tiny mistake. It's not of something of massive consequence or importance, but It just shows that, you know, they're not infallible.
No, they're not infallible. And that at least puts us in the... And with this chapter, this puts us in a situation where it's clear the Fae have more knowledge and power, but they're not infallible. They are, however, fucking terrifying, because every time they said that there are rules and that there are consequences, I believed them.
Yeah, and when the Fae say there are some things even we can't do, given what we've seen them being able to do so far, that's worrisome, to put it mildly.
Yeah, and the chapter ends on such an ominous note of Ryoka being, like, lost in a blizzard and Zell Shiver Trail launching, like, marching his army all the way and overhead. There's this line that's, she saw a young Nal in her mind and knew that she could not fail. Ryoka ran on, and overhead, the fairies watched her slow progress with eyes that beheld immortality.
What could possibly go wrong?
And the last line is literally just fate. Pirate does horror so well, and they blended it beautifully with the kind of anticipatory cliffhanger kind of deal here. And it just, yeah.
I don't think they're good at horror. I think they're good at despair.
I disagree. I think they're great at horror because you know that the clown, there are many, many chapters where they do horror, straight up horror, and it really does work out.
Okay, well then I'll rephrase that. They're good at horror, but this is not a case of horror. It's a case of despair.
Okay, so, okay. And then the chapter, like, ominous note of the Nal tribe being surrounded by thousands of figures and the Nal flesh being ripped away and then, and then the Nal, dead Nal coming back to life. Like, there are so many creepy things that happen at the end of this chapter, and it's just, I don't know. It was a lot, and it just, like, hit me, and I remember reading through this so fast, being flabbergasted, and reading the next 10 chapters, trying to find out what the fuck happened.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Yeah,
and this was a short one. Relatively speaking, it was pretty short. Pirate usually writes longer, even in the volume 2 days. Pirate talks about it in the... Oh, wait. I shouldn't say the author note. Cut that shit out. What did you think of the ending, and do you have any more thoughts?
When I read through this the first time around, I didn't really have any thoughts because I immediately just jumped to the next chapter, thinking, oh god, now that's a cliffhanger, I need to know what happens. That's really most of what was going on in my mind the first time when I read it.
It really is. It's such a good setup chapter, and I kind of wish... Do you want to do the next chapter, too?
No. I do not have the time.
Okay, so we're good. The author note talks about how this was a shorter chapter, and that... Pirate was watching the news and told people to vote. I don't know for what exactly. I don't remember what was happening in June of 2017, but apparently there was something happening.
Oh, is that for one of the Stabby Awards that they got?
I don't know. It says busy, busy, busy. Also, the news is big in both the UK and America. Vote or watch hearings. It's all drama. And here I am typing away in the hopes that someone will find this chapter interesting. I don't know what the fuck that means. I think it's the midterms that Pirate's talking about or something. I don't know. It's a long time ago.
Clearly they're talking about the events of Venezuelan basket weaving, don't you know? No, I have genuinely no idea.
Okay, so I do want to highlight one comment from a Dragon's Owl on June 9th, 2017. Thanks for the chapter. I'm guessing that the price for the child will be the entire tribe dying to this white Walker-esque force. It could be the necromancer, but I feel like he's still busy on his masterpiece that he would be behind the army instead of in front of it. I don't think it's the Goblin Lord because of how the Nals are dying coming back, though we never know what kind of magic the Southern Goblin tribe used, only that they had it. But I guess that the Black Skull insignia might have been foreboding here? Can't wait for chapter 2. This was a two-parter. I really want to see what this villainous force will end up being. If it is the Goblin Lord, the animals are gone because the goblins were hungry. If it is some evil force coming down from the mountains, it is because the animals were smart and ran away. I remember thinking these exact things. I figured it was the Goblin Lord or the Necromancer. It had to be. I mean, there was undead, right?
Yeah. The only thought, really, for me was, oh, they did. Although, a little side note is that I forgot to mention was when Ryoka was having her monologue train of thoughts talking about how she spent her time recouping, it was pretty funny to imagine her practicing a flashbang spell in a cave for 2 days. It's like, yeah, that's how you're gonna develop tinnitus, you dummy.
There's another comment by Anyavar on May 12, 2019. And I'm not going to read it out, but essentially the comment is about how Ryoka to the fairy says thanks in this chapter more than once, while having already warned Eren about not thanking the Fae because, as everybody is supposed to know, when you thank someone, it's as if you owe them something. And owing something to the Fae is never a good idea. Because the Fae will take you at your word, because they care about your word. And if you say you owe them something, they will expect you to do something for them.
Yes, you give your thanks, so they take your thanks.
But they can say, I don't need you, I'm not going to take your thanks, but I'll take your children.
Fairy logic is something I don't ever want to try to understand.
I mean, it's still an exchange. You thank them, clearly they owe you, but they don't need your thanks. That's a terrible thing to give me, that's a bad gift. How about this? I'll take your children, you give me your thanks, it's good. It's good, we're all good, you don't have to thank me. I'll just take your babies away. This is literally why people don't thank the Fae. And Pyra is generally careful about things like this. So I do wonder if it was a deliberate choice on Pyra's part for Ryoka to thank the Fae in this case. And for the Fae to explicitly not take advantage of that.
Yeah, the fact that they actually go out of their way to warn Ryoka about not stepping over certain lines, like when she tries to get them to interfere by pointing out, like, you're really going to let a child die? Are you actually that cruel? And they respond with, we are not, I can't remember what the names of the creatures they mentioned were, but one of them was like red caps.
We're not Slough. We're not red caps. We're not, I forget the last one, but essentially describing some of the darker named Fae or monstrous creatures that are associated with the Fae.
Yeah, for them to say, like, we're not any of those things, don't say stuff that would offend us. It's like, despite how rude and obnoxious and irritating they've been, or how at the slightest provocation they seem to just go off on anyone, the fact that that wasn't being offended really speaks volumes of what being offended for them must actually look like.
I'm still, like, there's just a lot there. Yeah, and I like the chapter in general. Did you like it?
I enjoyed it. I really did. But
yeah,
for me, this isn't the kind of chapter I enjoy just by itself. It's a chapter that's part of an arc. So I look at it as the arc itself.
Narratively speaking, I thought it was very well done. I just enjoyed
chapters
that successfully complete that kind of narrative point of view and the narrative goal properly. Like, it's very satisfying to me. So that's our review of the two chapters, and before we head off, this will be a short episode. We usually leave with a question for folks to respond to. I don't have any emails to read this week because we recorded like 5 episodes within a few days of each other. So here's something for everybody. Taking it back a second.
What's one time that you've tempted fate and suffered the consequences?
I was going to ask something else, but yeah, that's a good question. Have you ever tempted fate? I was going to ask, do you guys know any fairy stories or like little things that your grandmother or your mother told you, like, don't step on a crack, the kids thing where if you step on a crack, you'll break your mother's back? That's never happened, by the way. But those little fairy stories, those warnings, if you were in world, what kind of warning would you remember to your, would that interacting with the Fae, what warning would come to your mind? Cause I'll tell you what mine would be. It's not that it never make deals or anything with the Fae. It's always, always give the Fae a gift. Always have a gift for the Fae. Like, if you give them something, they will treat you well. And if you can't give them something of worth, find out where you can get something of worth. Because it's always worth respecting and gifting the Fae. Because even if they never give you something back, you've still done more. Because their presence is supposed to... They're arrogant enough to consider their presence a gift. So when they present themselves to you and then you don't give them a gift back, it's like insulting them. It's part of why the whole thing about, you know, leaving milk out for, like, the fairies to drink was a whole thing. Because if you give them a gift, they won't you know, they won't fucking fuck with you, right?
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. Sorry, that was really rambly.
No, but it makes sense.
Okay. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next week. Say bye, I was about to say Dragonus. Say bye, Gunman.
Glad to think glad to know that I remind you of Dragonus, I guess. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you all have a great day.
You don't remind me of Dragonus so much as I've done this with Dragonus so often that it kind of feels weird for him not to be here. But, yeah, bye, everybody. See you later.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins,
edited by Liquid Ender.
The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at No Killing Goblin, or email us at nokillinggoblins with an S at gmail.com.